Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last week. Last week, we were looking at the major economic events of 2016 and discussing the impact and potential for continuing effect of these events in 2017 and made some economic predictions at the time. Well, as we said at the end of that show, today we're going to continue and do the same for major political events of the last year, U.S. and global, and what is their likelihood of continuing impact, and make some predictions for 2017 on the political side as well as the economic side. Okay, so let's just recap briefly the major economic events and our predictions. Okay, we'll summarize here, recap and summarize, so we have a little bit of a comparison on the political side, because they're obviously related. Political events, economic events are integrated here. You can't separate one and the other in many cases. Okay, so what were our main economic forecast for 2017? Last week for the U.S. economy. As I said, my previous prediction of a slip into a recession early in 2017, I've taken off the table because we've got now this euphoria and anticipation by U.S. corporations and businesses that there's going to be big tax cuts and there's going to be something called infrastructure spending, and that's going to boost profits. So we see the anticipation in the markets always comes first, and we see this huge boom called the Trump trade sometimes in the stock markets, which particularly banks and others have boosted stock prices significantly here just since November. Significant increase in capital incomes as a result for investors and corporations and so forth. So that's going to carry on into the early half, this honeymoon period here. And my prediction for recession in U.S. Is going to late 2017, more likely 2018, as the effects wear off here and it becomes clear that this isn't going to do much for the economy, U.S. economy, and as global conditions also begin to weaken perceptively here by the end of the year. Okay, so no recession, but we could very well have a relapse of sort, as we have had many times, five times now since 2008, in the early winter, first quarter of 2017 here. It's probably not going to be as severe a relapse. Relapse, in my definition, of course, is a one-quarter stagnation or decline in U.S. GDP, not extended to two and subsequent quarters, as opposed to a recession, which is a longer stagnation decline in GDP numbers. Okay, so we may have a relapse, and in fact, we can see the numbers come out today for job creation down to 150,000, which will probably be much less. I predict something like maybe 100,000 jobs in the first quarter, maybe even less, will be created because there's great weaknesses in those job numbers. And, of course, we see a bad holiday retail sales occurring. The data is now coming out. Autos have pretty much peaked. We can expect those to come down. Rate increases by the Fed. If there are three rate increases, that's going to dampen auto sales and housing sales. So we're going to have slowing in those two sectors. And as we get maybe a little bit more boost in inflation. We're going to have continuing problems here with real wages, which are growing at the top 10%, 15% of the workforce, but for the rest is stagnant or declining. There could be a little bit boost as some at the very low end as some states introduce higher minimum wages. But basically, it's a lot of smoke and mirrors that's going to occur here in the first half. One of the big issues of last year was inequality. Inequality, as studies have shown, income inequality in the U.S., 97% of all the net income gains in 2015, and likely 16, even worse, went to the wealthiest 1% households. That was a major development. It's been growing, of course, but getting worse over the years here since the 1990s. And that's not simply because of wage stagnation going on, but even faster acceleration of capital incomes from stock booms and bond bubbles and speculation in currencies and derivatives and property assets, et cetera, all across the board, all made possible by these significantly low interest rates created by the Federal Reserve, which is frozen at the same time fixed income interest for middle class and average families here and retirees. Inequality is a function of two things: lack of real earned income growth, wages basically, and on the other hand, accelerating capital income growth. And it's the accelerating capital income growth that has been contributing even more for the growing inequality. Liberals try to focus on wages as the lack of wage growth, and that's true. It plays a role, but the big cause is runaway capital income growth. Dividends and capital gains and commissions and so forth, right? Okay. We also had a stock bubble that emerged at the end of last year, and that's going to continue as the bond bubble unwinds, the previous bond bubble unwinds in the U.S. as interest rates by the Fed are raised. So we will continue. We predicted that stocks will continue to accelerate. And we also talked about Fed rate increases, and which are coming. That's no great prediction. Infrastructure spending, whatever that animal is, we don't know yet, but I predict it's going to be mostly tax cuts and subsidies. It's going to be very capital intensive. Not going to create a lot of jobs real quick. And the Fed rate hikes will kill more jobs than in 2017 than the infrastructure spending will create. And in the meantime, we're going to have drug companies and healthcare companies, now that it looks like the Affordable Care Act is gone, are going, or in part at least, they will continue accelerating their price gouging. So we're going to see an acceleration on that plane as well in prices. Okay, we also predicted for Europe that the European Central Bank will continue its QE throughout the end of the year, even though the euro, the currency, is declining. We predicted it would decline to parity in the U.S., prediction we made several years ago. You would think that if they've achieved their devaluation through QE monetary policy, that there would be no need, and the ECB would, like the Japanese Bank of Japan, we'll talk about shortly, sort of suspend its increase in its QE. But we've got in Europe a great political instability that's driving the situation there. We have European banks led by Italian banks in deep trouble. And we'll probably see an eruption of the Greek debt issue here after the German elections later in the year. And in the meantime, the differentials in interest rates mean that capital continues to flow out of Europe to the U.S., driving down the euro and driving up and one of the several forces driving up the dollar, which is going to continue. That's one of our other forecasts for the U.S. economy, that as Fed rates rise and differentials occur in global interest rates, that the dollar will rise. Okay, so Europe, QE on hold, European banks, Italian banks in trouble, debt crises growing, and capital flight to the U.S. In Japan, as I said, the prediction was that the Bank of Japan will hold off, as it has indicated, in deepening its QE even further. Right now, the Bank of Japan probably owns half of all the bonds in Japan, not just government bonds, but corporate bonds as well. I mean, it's an immense issue here when the central bank props up all this buying, the central bank of buying these, not just its own bonds back, QE, but buying corporate bonds, and even Japan, of course, buying stocks, is really should be viewed as the central bank, the state, you know, it's the appendage of the state, the central bank, actually propping up capital profits and capitalism itself. The private capital markets and banks, private banks, cannot survive without massive financial monetary support by the state. This is something that's changed dramatically here in the last couple of decades, right? The state is propping it up. On the monetary side, it's the central bank doing the job. Okay. For emerging markets, we predicted more what's called tantrums, something taper tantrums and so forth. In other words, a response, emotional, dramatic response by the economies in emerging markets to rising rates in the U.S. And that's going to occur here, we predict, significantly as their currencies decline and their capital flight occurs, and they attempt emerging markets to raise their domestic interest rates to stem the outflow of capital. That means rising rates and rising import inflation, therefore deeper recessions. We can see this happening in Latin America in particular, in the big three economies down in South America, Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, and now we're beginning to see it in Mexico as well. Okay, we predicted that one of the big events last year, of course, was the stabilization of oil prices, but we predicted the deal would will fail. There will be cheating on it by Russia and others, and U.S. Fracking companies will increase the supply in response to the higher price. Prices will stabilize around low 60s per barrel, will not go higher. At the same time, commodity prices are rising because countries, particularly China and others, are trying to buy up supplies at the low prices before they rise. We will see probably a dollar debt payment crisis in Latin America. Latin America is the very weak link of all this. China, what we predicted was devaluation, and of course it's knocking on the door there. China is spending trillion, has so far spent about $1 trillion to prop up its currency, to keep it within the band that it fluctuates to the U.S. between 6.2, 6.9 yuan per dollar. And they're continuing to do so because they want to establish the yuan as part of a global currency, which they've been granted the first access to do so by the IMF. So they're trying to protect that. They will attempt to spend even more to ensure the yuan stays within that band, but I predict that it will slip before the end of the year. There's tremendous capital flight going on out of China, and if it doesn't stabilize its currency, that will provide greater demand for capital to flow out of China. The shadow banks. There's a running battle between the Chinese government and the shadow bankers over there for years now, and it's continuing. There are imposed controls on capital flows to try to stem this, but it's not working perfectly. The real estate bubble, which reemerged in China, has been dampened again. But where is all that excess liquidity going to go? Well, it's going to rotate to another financial bubble somewhere in China, which it has been doing, rotating between asset management products and real estate and state-owned enterprise debt and stocks. As Chinese government puts a damper on one, it just sort of slips into another bubble somewhere else, or it the liquidity flows out of the country, which China does not want. So the money keeps sloshing around within China from bubble to bubble, and the government keeps reacting to bubble after bubble because it simply created too much liquidity over the last five years. Real GDP will continue to slow. It's really around 4 to 5%. You know, it will stay or slow a little bit more in China, right? And China will continue to spend massive currency reserves to try to keep its currency within that band, because if it devalues, and when it does devalue, it will send shockwaves throughout Asia economies and elsewhere in the world, and will intensify currency wars. Okay, and India now slowing fast because of its policies here of converging of certain denominations of bills. And the real problem there is non-performing bank loans. Of course, that's a problem not only there, but in Japan and in Europe as well, global non-performing bank loans. Okay, so that was our forecast economically. And our predictions. Our predictions, you know, the major events of last year and our predictions economically. Well, okay, let's turn to politics. What were the main political events of 2016, and what's their impact likely in 17? And, you know, what are my predictions on the political side? Right. Okay. Well, to begin with, obviously in the U.S., it was Trump, right? The Trump win. That was the big shocker. And behind that, of course, you can't explain the Trump win without the implosion of the Democratic Party. Right? If you look with some historical perspective on the Trump win and the implosion of the Democratic Party, it becomes clear that the Democratic Party was in decline for decades now. And the only way it won in the last several decades is when the Republicans split themselves or we had the 2008 crash, right? I mean, Bill Clinton gets into office in 1992-3 only because the Republican side is split. With Ross Perot undermining a lot of Republican votes and denying, as a result, George Herbert Walker Bush, Daddy Bush, you know, the presidency in the second term. Bill Clinton did not win with a majority, but only with a plurality of votes. Okay, so that's the reason you got this aberration in this long-term decline. The Democratic Party has been in decline since the 1970s, right? They had a tremendous opportunity with Dick Nixon and, you know, his impeachment and the loss of Vietnam, if you call it a loss. Well, for them, it was a loss. And runaway inflation and the collapse of the economy, all brought on by Nixon policies. And they had a tremendous opportunity. And what did they do? They elected this peanut farmer called Jimmy Carter from Georgia, a real conservative candidate, instead of pushing and taking progressive politics one step further that they could have. You know, put restrictions on themselves, and they took the easy way out. And what did Jimmy Carter do? Well, he did nothing. His first term, in the first 2 years, in the second 2 years, he turned Republican, trying to placate the Republicans by adopting tax and other policies that the Republicans were calling for at the time. So the Republicans took his policies, and then they dumped them, you see. They forced Paul Volcker on him, and Paul Volcker, Federal Reserve Chair, raised interest rates, and then there was that disastrous attempt to free the hostages in Iran at the time, and which ended in a debacle. And so rising interest rates, no growth in Iran, debacle, that was the end of Jimmy Carter. He was toast. But Jimmy Carter, you know, it was one of the weakest presidents we've ever had and did terrible and just paved the way for Ronald Reagan. You know, the policies that Ronald Reagan introduced were being developed in the last 2 years of Jimmy Carter. And Reagan just ran with them and implemented them, that's all. And the Democrats thought, well, you know, this is temporary. Ronald Reagan is so outrageous, you know, he won't last, so forth, you know. Well, he lasted 8 years. And then his vice president, George Herbert Walker Bush, took over for another 4 years. I mean, it didn't sink into the Democrats that this was not temporary, that this had something to do with their failures. So the Democratic Party turned in the late 80s to a neoliberal direction, and its corporate wing took over, called the Democratic Leadership Conference, and they put their boy Bill Clinton in, and, you know, free trade and all the other stuff. We know that history. And that's been disastrous for the Democratic Party to become Republican light and to push free trade, so forth, the Clinton approach. It looked like a victory, but it just rotted the Democrat foundation from the base. And then when, you know, George W. Bush, baby Bush, came in 2000, you know, he just took a lot of the moderate neoliberal stuff that policies that Clinton had introduced and just blew them open, blew the door wide open on just about everything, tax cuts and free trade and privatizations and so forth. And we know that whole history, deregulation and et cetera, financialization, and led to the 2008 crash. Well, you know, anybody could have won in 2008 against George Bush or the Republicans and the disaster that they created with their policies. And, of course, Obama was handpicked by a wealthy billionaire class, the Chicago mob of the corporate capitalists, you know, Pritzkers and so forth, picked out of obscurity in some low, I think it was in the assembly, maybe the Illinois State Senate or something like that. He wasn't even there 2 years, and they handpicked him out, and they pushed him, put him into the U.S. Senate, and then, of course, you know, picked him at the last minute and pushed him in front of Hillary Clinton in the 2008. He was the last entrant into that campaign. Well, that was their boy, but, you know, it was a false left progressivism, and everyone was super hopeful. But, of course, he dashed all that real quick. We'll be having a show here on Obama's legacy in the near future, and I'll be writing on that as well. It's not a pretty legacy, no matter what they try to do to gloss it over here and praise him as he goes out the door. But, you know, if you look in context, while these special case victories at the national level for the Democrats in 92 and in 2008 make it look like the Democrats are competitive, underneath the whole party was rotting. They were losing all kinds of positions in governorships and state legislatures and so forth, not paying attention to that or their policies, of course. We're not, they could not sell those policies very effectively at the state and local level, and the Democratic Party, of course, lost everything. Has, you know, what, two-thirds of all the governorships and state legislatures are now Republican hands. I mean, you talk about a unified Republican government here. Now at the national level, well, you know, two-thirds of the states have the same thing. The party is imploding, and you can see its desperation in what they what they did during the primaries here, particularly to attempts to reform it and to bring it back to its roots. Bernie Sanders, right? No way. The corporate elite in the Democratic Party is going to allow Sanders to win, superdelegates notwithstanding. If they didn't have superdelegates, or if that firewall did not stop Sanders, then they had other things planned at the convention to do so. Nonetheless, we see Bernie Sanders still tilting at windmills here. You know, Don Quixote Bernie trying to reform the Democratic Party. Okay. So the Trump win and the Democratic Party implosion, big events of last year. As I've written on my blog, jackrasmus.com, the Trump win obviously had to do with him knowing, understanding the discontent, the economic discontent, and appealing with his propaganda to those sectors that had clearly been harmed the most by free trade and Democratic Party and Republican Party establishment. You know, the non-Trump traditional elites of the Republicans, just as bad as the, in fact, worse than the Democratic Party on these key issues. And that's why Trump attacked them as well. If he hadn't attacked the Republican establishment the way he did, he would not have won either. You see, I mean, he was the anti-establishment, anti-party, established party candidate, the only one in the race there, and clearly, you know, that prevailed for him. You know, he was against the Republican elites as well as the Democratic elites, and that's why they all were attacking him on both sides. Well, both sides, they're sort of connected like Siamese twins here, Republicans and Democrats now, at least the establishment figures in those parties. So, you know, he was able to appeal to that, and you could see where he got the votes for that. Black American, African Americans did not turn out to vote for Hillary. Latinos did not turn out, and the youth stayed home because, you know, they were voting. Most of them, you know, were Sanders. And union labor and labor in the Great Lakes states did not vote. In fact, they crossed the aisle and voted Republican. You know, and if you look at the constituencies in 2012 election, it were those same constituencies that put Obama over and allowed him to have a second term, right? Give him one more chance, which he failed at. But it was, you know, the union vote in the Great Lakes industrial area that put him over. The Latinos put him over. African Americans put him over. That's how he won in the youth. That's how he won again in 2012, even though he did not deliver. They were willing to give him another shot, and he took it, and he blew it. Well, he didn't blow it because he never intended to do anything. But we'll save our critique here for the Obama Legacy Show in that regard. But anyway, okay, so the big events, Trump and Democratic Party implosion, prediction for 2017. Trump, of course, is going to drive home his policies that big implications, and the Democrats aren't going to be able to stop him. And the Democrats are going to, I predict, look even weaker than they've ever been. And people don't vote for weak choices. Well, what are we going to see in Trump policies? I've said before and written on my blog, jackrasmus.com, that priority number 1, 2, 3 is tax cuts for corporations and investors, big time. ACA, Obamacare, you know, pull it apart. And Dodd-Frank, put it to bed. Those are the three main tasks that you're going to see. And by the way, the Republican establishment in Congress and Trump are on the same page as far as all of that is concerned. Trump has proposed $6.2 trillion of mostly investor and corporate tax cuts. That's coming. And we'll be looking at that as it gets better defined as we go forward here with the show in 2017. Very important, because it's really a continuation of neoliberal tax policies, you know, for decades now. Bush gave $3.4 trillion in tax cuts to corporations and investors. Obama extended it for the first 2 years, from 2010 to 2012, and at the cost of $500 billion. And then in 2013, He cut the deal, the fiscal cliff, which continued the Bush tax cuts, $5 trillion over the next decade. And what we've got is a Trump here with $6.2 trillion more. Okay. And by the way, how are they going to pay for that $6.2 trillion? They're going to take away a lot of middle-class deductions. They're talking about state and local government deductions. They're talking about a whole number of things here in which taxes will be raised on the middle class to help pay for. And, of course, we'll have cuts in all kinds of discretionary spending on the federal side as well to help pay for it. Okay, ACA, the battle has been opened on what's going to happen with ACA here, and just starting. You know, will they repeal and then try to do something with ACA? Well, 75% of the American electorate, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation research, does not want to repeal or until they see what happens. What are you going to replace it with? Half of the American people say no repeal, period, no changes, and the other quarter percent say, well, let's see what it is. Only 25% want outright appeal. Well, will the Republicans overreach in Congress? Well, they might. Well, we'll see, because there are some provisions there that are very desirable. But the big problem with ACA, Obamacare, is that it never controlled prices, you see, never controlled costs. What people got was this high deductible, low coverage something. They didn't have anything before. Now they had something. But it's, you know, the whole ACA was really not a health care reform act. It was a health insurance company subsidy act. $900 billion paid for partly by taxpayers, partly by taxes on the rich. And that's why, you know, of course, the Republicans are very much opposed to it because of that surtax levy that paid for part of the refunds for people if they signed up. You know, but the big beneficiaries were the health insurance companies and the whole health lobby, and that's why they went along with it, you see. As long as they could make more money out of the deal, that's why they went with it. But it was a disaster from the beginning. As soon as Obama unilaterally pulled the public option, that was the end of that. And, of course, they won't even allow any discussion of Medicare as a solution, which is the only solution to this healthcare crisis in the U.S. That's going to get worse. It's going to cost more. People are going to get less while the Republicans and the Democrats will cave in on it and argue, well, we saved something. We did the best we could, you know, that minimalist argument that you always hear from the Democrats. So ACA is going to be a target. Dodd-Frank, which, you know, was one of a weak, a very weak financial regulation bill, didn't do anything to really restrain the banks. And that's going to pretty much go away, Dodd-Frank. They will repeal most of that. Okay, so that's for 2017. The consequence of the Trump win is going to be focused on those three biggies. Well, what about the rest? What about immigration? What about foreign policy? What about civil liberties and so forth? Well, that's coming too, but it's not the priority, right? What you're going to see on free trade, as I talked about, is a lot of this hyping of individual Trump interventions, you know, like Carrier Corporation, Ford, and, you know, recently trying to focus target on some of the Japanese auto companies and Mexico and so forth. You know, that doesn't change very much. And if you look below it, you know, let's take the case of Carrier. Oh, big hype. But Carrier said, okay, we will keep 800 jobs here. Well, but they're still going to move 1,000 jobs, you see. And how long are they going to keep the 800 here? Will they eventually remove even the 800, replacing it with new automation, new capital equipment, you know, with the tax cuts coming for them. Yeah, I think they know that they can do that. And they can argue, well, we didn't move the jobs to Mexico. We just eliminated them here because the government has been subsidizing us with this big depreciation and other tax cuts. So we're just replacing labor here and jobs with new equipment and capital equipment, you see. We've lost as much employment in manufacturing to new capital investment as we had to free trade. Free trade, he's opposed to TPP and other free trade deals, but he's not he's a bilateral free trader. He's going to renegotiate country by country. You know, U.S. country this, U.S. country that, bilateral free trade. He's still a free trader, you see. He's just the... you know, not a multilateral free trader. What about immigration? Well, he says he's going to deport 2 to 3 million. Yeah, I think he will. After all, that's what Obama deported. It's not impossible. And he will deport 2 to 3 million people. He says they're all criminals. Actually, less than a million have any kind of a record in terms of law violation. So 2 to 3 million is going to really stretch. You know, a lot of innocent people are going to get deported. He will start building some sort of token fence. Mm-hmm. But there's no way they're going to finance a fence across the entire southern border. Right? That was just propaganda during election. We will see a deal with Russia here in Syria. That's coming. But taking apart NAFTA or taking apart the Iran deal, no. That is there'll be talk about that, a lot of smoke. But no fire, and that will come later, slowly, and in a token fashion. There'll be some adjustment to NAFTA, but it'll take years, you see. And the Republican elite party will continue to support him as long as he cuts taxes and ACA and regulations and so forth, right? They'll do that. They won't go after him for his foreign policy revolution, if it is that. Well, is it really? No. We're seeing a hard pivot to China, but that was, of course, begun by Obama. But now we're seeing, and I predict, a new concerted effort between the U.S. with Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea, putting pressure on China here. And we could see the beginning of a trade war with China. But it's all bargaining. You see, this is all part of Trump's country-to-country kind of negotiate the deal, right? He wants to soften up China, and he wants to negotiate with China. And all these moves are shifting and maneuvering before the negotiations begin. Okay, so the consequence, predictions, we're going to see all that. Big tax cuts. ACA will be picked apart, obviously. Dodd-Frank will be gone. We'll see bilateral free trade and token publicity stunts, company by company. We will see a fence, but it will be token too. We will see deportations. There will be a deal with Russia and a hard pivot to China. And on the domestic side, we will see a real crackdown on civil liberties and protests. You know, Black Lives Matter and Standing Rock, those kind of issues, we'll see tough interventions and police repression. Okay, in Europe, predictions, political predictions in Europe. I believe we're going to see some very interesting developments in European elections. Last year, of course, we saw Brexit, where the U.K. Voted to leave the European Union. And then we saw the Italian referendum vote, which was related to that, in which the population stopped centralization of power within the northern corporate-led, Italian corporate-led elites wanting to focus political control in Rome and in their own hands so that they could implement the policies that they wanted. Well, that was checked, you see. Now there'll be Italian elections next year, but so will there be French elections next year. And that's really going to be the interesting development in France. Will the National Front, the right wing over there, that's very friendly with the Brexiters in the UK and Trump, you know, will they prevail as well? They're calling for a Frexit, French exit from the EU. If the National Front wins, Europe will start to unravel. The Eurozone will start to unravel even before it actually happens. That will have a major impact on the economy and globally as well, if that occurs. And of course, if that occurs, then you will quickly see the Netherlands and Austria, which has significant both right-wing movements. Austria almost prevailed here in election, deepened their influence as well. And in Germany, elections will occur in September. If France goes National Front, then Germany, the right wing, far right, is already growing. The ADF is already growing and could become significant as well. As Europe unravels, will make Brexit look tame in comparison. If the National Front wins, and they have a shot at it, right? And you see the Socialist Party, all of the Social Democrat parties, have collapsed or become junior partners to Euro neoliberalism, and have discredited themselves. Socialist Party couldn't win a position for dog catcher in Paris right now. Their erstwhile president, there, Hollande, I think has single-digit ratings. their new candidates are talking left, but I don't think people believe him anymore. The Republican Party, which is another corporate party, is trying to outflank the National Front, talking even more Trump-like. François Fillon is his name. We're going to see some interesting politics in France over the next couple months here. And how France goes, goes Europe. That simple. And it could go. in other words, watch Europe now politically. The economy is going to be driven by politics over there. We could also see, I would say, 50-50 chance a resumption of migrations into Europe. Turkey is very unstable, and Turkey is the key. Turkey could just simply open the doors once again. It's been bribed by the Europeans and paid off to close those doors, but it could open them just as easy, right? The whole question is, if there's a deal in Syria, will that mean the end of the pressure for emigration from Syria in the Middle East? No, I don't think so. It may even increase it. If people see that now they can get out, they will, right? And, of course, we have North Africa immigration into Italy and other places continuing as well. Okay. prediction, Russia will win in Syria. They've almost de facto done so, which means the U.S. strategy has collapsed, which was to place their bets on all these radical groups, including Al-Qaeda. There's evidence the U.S. was funding Al-Qaeda groups in its effort to topple Assad in Syria, you know. That whole Obama strategy totally collapsed. It's done. And Russia has prevailed there. The U.S. has left the Middle East in shambles. Maybe that was the plan from the very beginning. And now it wants out. That's why it cut a deal with Iran. And Trump will cut a deal with Syria. It looks like the U.S. was behind the attempted coup here in Turkey. And Turkey, of course, now is anti-U.S. Except for Israel, that we keep funding, U.S. has no friends there. And, of course, except for the strange friends called the Saudis, who thwart U.S. policy at all kinds of junctures. It could mean even more trouble for the royal family in Saudi Arabia. But I won't predict that. Okay, what happened last year, too, was very clearly we had some legal coup d'etats in Latin America with significant U.S. Surreptitious funding and assistance of various kinds. We had a legal coup in Brazil and in Argentina, and corporate right-wing interests have taken over in both of those countries. And as soon as they did, they paid off U.S. hedge funds in Argentina, and came hat in hand to Washington, New York, and got more money for themselves. The elites down there, the elites are still going after the remnants of the center left governments there, Kirchner's and in Brazil as well, even Lula. They're stamping out anything on the progressive left, but what's going to happen there is you're going to have much more intense, I predict, street level grassroots uprisings and protests. The one area they haven't been able to pull off the coup, although they've done everything they can, is in Venezuela. That fight is still up in the air. But last year, of course, these coup d'etats in South America, major developments, but they are going to lead to, as we get more economic crises deepening in Latin America, you're going to see a lot more political uprisings and resistance at the popular level in Latin America, in those countries. Right. And also in Mexico for other reasons, economically, trade, and so forth, privatizations, et cetera. So Latin America, that was an interesting development last year, and that's going to continue to reverberate here in 2017, as will the collapse of the U.S. policy in Syria and the Middle East. That's going to reverberate in 17. Of course, the situation with European elections, a big question mark, what's going to happen. All right, we see the collapse of TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership under Obama, and we will now have a reversion back to bilateral free trade deals. The TTIP, which was the a corresponding free trade deal that Obama had planned for Europe, is now shelved because of the not only the failure of TPP and new regime, but also because of the instability in Europe. Okay, what about the Iran deal cut by Obama? I don't see any big change in that. That's not priority for the Trumps. The domestic policy is priority. Trade is priority. The U.S. had already begun to turn away from the Middle East and shift to China in the Far East. So the Iran deal, was part of, we're going to tie up some loose ends the best we can in the Middle East, and we're going to shift to obviously the more important issues for U.S. capitalists, and that is the Far East, China, and what's happening in Korea and Japan and elsewhere. So the Iran deal, I don't see any. There'll be smoke and mirrors here. There won't be a lot of big changes there. Okay. Black Lives Matter, Standing Rock, popular discontent movements within the U.S., what's going to happen there? As I said, there'll be a crackdown on civil liberties, and you'll see more police action and police oppression in 2017 with regard to those two movements and those kinds of movements in the U.S. Okay, look, if Trump says people ought to be jailed for burning the U.S. flag, I mean, you can imagine what he's going to do when there's real issues at stake. All right, so that's our prediction, crackdown civil liberties and those movements. Obama's pivot to China, as I said, was really pathetic from the capitalist point of view. and Trump now will make a hard pivot. And you could see the beginnings already beginning to emerge here. The whole attempt to intervene here and the single reverse the single China policy of the U.S. and say, well, then, you know, Taiwan is not part of China, is an attempt to put pressure on China and to pull away China interest here in Taiwan, reestablish, deepen U.S. influence in Taiwan. Japan, you know, not by accident that Shinzo Abe was the first to greet Trump. I think, you know, he comes hat in hand to Trump, and what he's always wanted most was to increase defense spending and remilitarize Japan. Now he's going to have his opportunity, you see. I think Trump will give the green light to remilitarize Japan, and that, of course, will really raise the hackles of the Chinese. But that's his intent. You see, this is the way he negotiates. He comes hard, and he aggravates, and he you know, outrages, and then he wants to sit down and negotiate a deal. Well, you know, that's like property acquisition negotiations, right? This is the way he's always done it, and the way he was taught to do it. On the business side, so he's just taken that and he's applying it to a foreign policy. Very dangerous, but nonetheless, he believes that's how it should be done, right? So pull away Taiwan, pull away Japan, aggravate North Korea here, not without reason. North Korea here, of course, he's got to do something to shore up the political system in South Korea with the impeachment of their, you know, radical right president there, which he will eventually intervene when he's in office to try to do. Will there be a trade war with China? I suspect there may begin to be a trade war with China of sorts, low scale. He's not going to go all out, but that will be another one of his ways of signaling to the Chinese, well, we got to renegotiate our agreements, you see. We've got to sit down bilaterally and renegotiate our political and economic agreements, China. Right? All these efforts are indicative of trying to soften up China, which is pretty hard to do, soften up the Chinese, but that's what he's planning to do here. Because Obama, you know, really talk. There was really no significant pivot going. You're going to see, you know, greater military cooperation with these countries. The U.S. Will develop some kind of policy of trying to prevent Australia from deepening its economic relationships with China. And at the same time, it has this task of what to do about the Philippines now, right? With this new president there making all this pro-China talk and anti-U.S. talk. There will be some policy that may be above board, you know, a carrot, below board, CIA stick, right? And it's not impossible that they may even assassinate that guy over there in the Philippines. I've forgotten the president's name. In any event, there will be a hard pivot all along the Asian front in a number of political ways. Turning back to the U.S., Bernie Sanders aborted a revolution, right? Saved the Democratic Party. For all they did to Bernie here, you know, he should have got the nomination, but they undermined him, they denigrated him, they humiliated him, they humiliated his supporters of the Democratic Party convention, and they're still, Bernie and friends, are still trying to reform that party. Still. Right, try to push this guy Ellison to run the DNC, Democratic National Committee, but of course he got slapped back here. The corporate elite is still running that party, and they're not going to allow Sanders to reform it. And that's why it will continue the Democratic Party on a downward spiral here. Right? Okay. So Japan remilitarization, Australia, Philippines, some new policies there. Sanders aborted revolution. The Democrats are meeting in a retreat this week. You know, what to do about this? They have no solution. you know, the Elizabeth Warrens and Bernie Sanders and all those are relegated and will still be relegated to an insignificant corner of the Democratic Party. And it's a waste of time trying to do anything in that that regard. Well, what about Iraq and Afghanistan? Well, we're seeing the Battle of Mosul going on now. Depending on how that turns out, we don't know exactly what Trump is going to do, but, you know, he has declared he's going to go after ISIS with the Russians. There'll be a deal maybe to go after ISIS with the Russians. He will prop up Iraq, but I predict they will try to find a way to get out of that 16-year war in Afghanistan. The Afghan government is collapsing. It's corrupt. It's can't rule. The Taliban is coming back. We've got 13,000 soldiers there still, and nothing changes. You know, do we still keep throwing trillions of dollars at that tribal hill warfare? 14th century country, right? Or do we somehow come to some conclusion that it's a waste of time and money? Well, Trump may do that. May. I don't know. You know, he's got generals in control. This is a government of billionaires and generals. You know, remarkable. And we'll see Trump and the media continue to fight it out because, you know, New York Times, Washington Post have not given up on doing something about building a case against him. The Republican League want the tax cuts and want the economic stuff that looks real now, and they won't touch him until then, but they will tame him, and they're preparing to do so at some point. And if he's not tameable, they'll go after him. I've written about that in read my blog, jackrasmus.com, Taming Trump, how they could do this, how they could tame Trump. Will they? Well, we don't know. He's got a pretty big ego, and he may insist on going his own route, but we will see. But the fight, you know, Washington Post and New York Times is going to continue to build their case against him and wait for the right opportunity to go after him. And we'll continue to see friction between Trump and the Democrats and the liberal media. Who prevails will be an interesting development in 2017. Okay, that's my overview of the key political events of the last year and how they're going to continue influence in this year and my predictions on the political side. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.